So by way of introduction, for those of you that are not KBL clients and don't know me already, I'm Sarah Collier, partner of KBL, and I'm heading up the employment department. Obviously spend a lot of our time, and particularly at the moment, advising clients and all of the commercial clients of KBLs on employment related matters. So yeah, that's me. And before we kick off, in terms of the content of today's session and the road out of lockdown, as you will have seen, there have been numerous updates this week following the government update on Sunday evening. And Rishi Sunak has announced on Tuesday that there is going to be an extension of the furlough scheme, so the coronavirus job retention scheme, as it's officially known. And that's going to be continuing until the end of October. Although we'll see it in its current form until the end of July, and then it's likely that there will be a little bit more flexibility in the scheme from July to October, whereby it will allow businesses to bring back employees on a part-time basis and share the cost of their salary in that period. So there is going to be a further sort of guidance note from the government with further details by the end of May on that scheme. And if you are signed up to our mailing list, then you will get that. If you're not signed up to the mailing list and you want to be, let us know, email Kirsty, or even add in the comments box now, and we will send you the link so that you can sign up and get our regular updates. My view is certainly that this extension of the furlough scheme is fantastic for businesses and will certainly be helping in this next stage, which I hope to be assisting with today, as I see it, as the planning stage of trying to get businesses back to where they were and work through from lockdown into to the stages that we know the government are intending to follow. Certainly this scheme is costing the government £14 billion a month. So as I said, there is an intention that from July onwards, there will be a weaning off of this scheme as much as possible for businesses. So I just wanted to update you on that, because that was a new update. As I said, by the end of May, we should have some further flesh on the bone for that. So in terms of today's session, this really is intended to be helping you formulate your plan for the coming weeks and months, which should hopefully see you out of lockdown. You know, as we heard from Boris on Sunday, this set plan that the government have put down is not set in stone. It's conditional upon the five tests being met. So of course, you know, it's subject to change. And I think that any plans that you should be putting in place would, you know, should also be changeable and movable over time in line with that of the government's. I think the government have come into a lot of criticism since Sunday's update, as they've moved away from their sort of stay at home message to their stay alert message. And no doubt you'll all have your own views on that. But I think what is clear is that they are still sending out this message to businesses that those individuals that can work from home should continue to work from home. However, the new message is that those that cannot continue to work from home, if they have been, such as in the sort of manufacturing, construction and engineering type sectors, then you can return to work. But the government has been quite clear that that is only if certain measures and adjustments are put in place by business. So again, today I want to be talking about that to you so that you can be factoring those adjustments and those plans for your businesses. As you will have heard from Boris on Sunday, the government have produced some guidance that is there to sort of assist businesses in the return of their workforce in a safe way. And the first of those guidance notes is our plan to rebuild. I'll just share my screen briefly so that you can see this first plan. So this is the guidance. We will provide links to these guidance notes that I'm going to refer to today in our follow-up email, and some of them will go in the comments section as well if you want to refer to them. So this section here has a little section which I've just highlighted, which is talking about The fact that employees should be listening to the advice of their employers. It's telling employees that their employer has a duty to assess and manage the risk in the workplace, and that social distancing should be adhered to, for example. So that's the first of the guidance notes. Within that guidance note, there's a section as to what employees need to know. So that's something that you should be looking at as well. There's then a separate guidance note, which again I will share just so that you can see it. One moment. Apologies. There it is. And this is a much more helpful note. This has got what you need to know. And again, I'll talk through a lot of these factors later down the line, but reiterating the point I've made that those that can work from home should continue to do. Those that are vulnerable and shielding should again remain to be supported by their employers. You know, social distancing should be in place, etc. So again, that's some further guidance. And then the government have produced the Working Safely During Coronavirus guidance. And for me, this is the most important that you should be looking at, because it's got 8 specific types of sector related guidance that specifically talk you through. So just to pick up on the factories, plants and warehouse, there is a specific guidance note that you can download here and that talks about what you as a business should be doing and putting in place. So I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. And I would definitely recommend that you sort of go back and look at those guidance notes. So in terms of today's session, what I want to talk about initially is your duty of care in terms of the measures that you're going to put in place to make it safe for your employees to come back to work, what's required from you in terms of the social distancing, and just a couple of other points on that sort of health and safety element in terms of whistleblowing and the risk that businesses might face and should be aware of. I'm also going to talk about some relevant policies and procedures that I think are sort of relevant during the pandemic and quite specific that, you know, points that I want to just raise in relation to those policies and procedures. And then I think one of the most important parts is getting the workforce back. You know, if you have got a significant number of your workforce on furlough, how you are going to be transitioning them back, the problems you might encounter in terms of the flexibility that staff may need around childcare, and we'll come on to that, and those that are shielding or just don't feel safe to return to work. I've also been doing quite a bit of advice in recent weeks on holidays, and so I want to talk a little bit about that in terms of, you know, how you should be dealing with holidays whilst employees are on furlough, if you have those on furlough, and also post furlough leave. And then finally, I think businesses are still, in spite of the fact that we've got this extension of the furlough scheme, are still potentially going to have to look at changing employees' terms and conditions. I've been talking to businesses in recent weeks about, you know, putting employees on 4-day weeks, or reducing their pay in line with what they had been on in furlough and associated hours associated with that. So again, talking about how you go about changing terms and conditions of employment. And then, of course, if redundancies can't be avoided, a bit of a whistle-stop tour on the redundancy process as well. But I think really the key message from today's webinar, from my perspective, is that you are now in the sort of preparing and planning stage, both in the short and medium term, and that you have a communication strategy, how you are going to communicate your plans with your staff and also with your customers to give them that reassurance of the steps that you're taking, you know, and you are required to be taking in line with the government's position. So in terms of the planning stage, for me, you need to start to sit down and be looking at the current position. You know, what volumes of work have you got? How do you envisage that's going to be changing in the coming weeks and months? And what workforce have you currently got, you know, at present? And again, what you will need to meet the demand of work in coming weeks, and how you can marry up the two. So I think there's questions that need to be answered are, you know, at the moment there are industries that aren't able to recommence work. So are you able to come back to work? You know, if you are, is it safe to do so? What safety measures can you be putting in place in line with the government guidance, which we've just seen in those sector related guidance notes? How are you going to affect social distancing in your workplace? You know, how are you going to get your staff slowly returned back, or will you bring them all back at once? You know, and if you are bringing them back on a staged basis, how are you going to select which employees come back in a fair manner? You know, what about those staff that are going to struggle to do that because of childcare arrangements? So I think all of these questions are points that you need to be looking at in terms of that planning and helping you pull your strategy together. And then, as I say, you know, once you've got that strategy in place and once you're comfortable with the measures that you're going to be taking, you need to start to communicate that with your staff who may well be, you know, having little communication at the moment in terms of being furloughed. You can speak to staff, even though they're not allowed to work, you can start to talk to them about the measures that you're putting in place and when they might be required to return to work. And of course, it's a vital time for sort of providing that reassurance to staff at this point. I was thinking about ways that you could do this, and I think this type of call that we've got going now, where you could have your HR or your director or whoever is responsible really for pulling your plan together and putting these safety measures in place, could have a Zoom type or Microsoft Teams types call, where you can brief staff on, you know, what are the new procedures, and, you know, remind them of the hygiene practices that were probably enforced before all of this happened. What information do they need to know in terms of, you know, what will keep them safe and what they need to adhere to when they're back at work? I think also identifying to them that you're there, you know, if they have concerns, if they want to discuss things, you can, you know, have those one-on-one discussions with them. And you know, these types of video calls might be useful from a departmental basis, so that different aspects of your business that have got different requirements and different challenges in terms of the requirement from the government to put these safety measures in place, you can deal with them on a specific basis then. Another thing that I think is really important at this point, and I know I've seen some criticism of the government's plan that was announced on Sunday, was this sort of lack of human element that I'd seen being mentioned. And, you know, I think it's key for businesses at this point to have that human element with staff. You know, we are all focused at the moment on trying to get business on track and the sort of business element of this. But I think ultimately, it will pay dividends if you are able to fully communicate with your employees, get them on board, you know, let them know that you're listening to them and any concerns they have. And I think that positive action and that positive communication will resonate with your staff over the coming months and years, you know, in terms of how it's been dealt with. And I've certainly seen very positive stories from businesses and what they're doing at the moment with their staff. You know, Friday fun sessions or whatever it might be, keeping that communication loop going. And those that employees are really feeling it and it's not working so well. So I think, as I said, that's key in terms of the communication of your strategy. So turning now to your duty of care, in light of these risks that are posed by COVID-19 and the requirements that the government are putting in place, both the Health and Safety Executive and the government are clear that all businesses need to have a risk assessment having been conducted that addresses all of the health and safety risks associated with businesses returning and staff returning to work and customers being there as well. There is reference to businesses having to have this in writing if they have over 5 staff. But for me, you know, that should be the case for all businesses. I would definitely recommend that it's in writing. And, you know, again, it is something that you can be using them government guidance notes as to what their expectations are to sit alongside and run alongside your risk assessment in terms of pulling that together. You might also want to do some loose type risk assessments for individual staff. You know, you might have staff that have got particular concerns or challenging issues. You may have staff that have lost family members through COVID-19. So I think, you know, there may be specific things that you want to pick up on and show that you are how you are looking at things from staff's individual perspectives. And I'm not suggesting you do the whole workforce, but there may be, as I said, staff with specific needs where that's recommended. And obviously, you need to keep a record of your risk assessment. One thing that we've pulled together is a sort of checklist, and it may not be, you know, entirely all encompassing for every type of business, but it's just to give you something to start with as points that you should be looking at, you know, both in terms of your planning and your risk assessment. So we will follow up with that in our follow up email and provide you with a copy of it. Obviously, if you've got specialist health and safety advisors on board, then they'll be assisting with this. But I know for many businesses, they'll be doing it themselves. So there is this legal responsibility on you to protect your workers from any health and safety risk, you know, and therefore your risk assessment is the first sort of port of call for that. What's quite clear is that your risk assessment should be you should consult with your employees in relation to that risk assessment. So once you've devised the safety measures you're going to put in place and you've communicated it to staff, that there's some form of, you know, ability for staff to come back and make suggestions and say things that they feel that might be relevant that should be introduced. So that consultation is absolutely key. So just a couple of sort of practical ideas. I'm sure all of your businesses are doing these things right now anyway, if you're back. But deep cleaning is something that's been, you know, continually referred to by the government as a means to keeping the infection levels down. And that's therefore, if you are going to be returning to work and you haven't been there for some time, having a deep clean beforehand, but also having that constant cleaning taking place each day and throughout the day, particularly in light of things like door handles, light switches, kettles, and other objects that are, you know, touched by many throughout the day. Social distancing is going to be a huge part of your planning process and how you are going to make that work as best you can. You know, great news is that the government don't expect every business are going to be able to keep every member of staff 2 metres apart. What they are saying is if that's possible, then you absolutely should be doing that. But if not, then we need to look at some mitigating factors as to how you can reduce the risk without that. And I'll come on to what they might be. It also talks about ventilation to help with airflow and PPE. Having said that, with PPE, I think it's well known in health and safety that that's the very last line of defence. And, you know, it may not be necessary within many of your businesses, but again, it's something that you should look at that government guidance, particularly for your sector, and see if there's any suggestions of things that you can and should be putting in place. Again, they also talk about this frequency of washing of hands and surfaces. And that's something that, again, prior to the lockdown, I'm sure your businesses had in place, but it's reminders of that for staff. And also reminding staff that if they have any symptoms, they should not be coming into the workplace whatsoever. On the social distancing front, as I said, you know, they understand that that won't be possible for all businesses. And so there is mitigation such as, you know, any activities that involve people being in very close proximity, being kept to as short a possible time as you can. Implementing screens or barriers, you know, as we're seeing in the supermarkets. Also using back to back or side to side working as opposed to people facing one another if they're having to work closely. And I think another key area is this, trying to minimise the number of people that your staff come into contact with. So if you can create smaller fixed teams or partnering where your employees are not necessarily mixing with the broader workforce, then again, that's another one of these sort of mitigating factors. The guidance notes talk a lot about staggering arrival and departure times where that's possible. just to avoid crowding into the workplace, you know, if you have got that sort of 9-to-5 type environment. And looking at public transport, you know, the government were clear on Sunday that where people are able to avoid using public transport, then they absolutely should do so. And so you might need to look at, you know, additional parking facilities if that's possible, bike racks for those that might be able to cycle to work. And I know in the office guidance note, it talks about how you're going to devise workplace type meetings. And again, there's guidance such as holding those in a way that, you know, that there are not face-to-face meetings, so using Zoom and Microsoft Teams. If you are in a meeting and it's not necessary to hold it in to avoid the in-person meeting, then doing it where people are spread 2 meters apart, trying to avoid sharing pens and other objects in meetings, and I think even making cups of tea, you know, if you're doing a round for 6 people, then obviously there's going to be that touching of those objects. So they are things that you can look at, and having hand sanitizer in all of your meeting rooms, making sure that the rooms are well ventilated, as I've said, and that there's signage up as well. So I did want to just share the fact that the government have produced some signage that you can use. And again, we will share this after today's session. I think this is it. So yeah, staying COVID-19 secure in 2020. And this is something you can just print and use within your business. Talking about the things that staff need to do. So again, we'll share that, as I say. As I mentioned, all of these proposals, all of these measures that you're going to put in place should be part of a consultation process with staff. And that might just mean, as I said before, having that Zoom type call and giving them the opportunity to come back. You know, it may even mean creating sort of a new type of health and safety forum where some staff volunteer to be part of the process of planning and putting all of these measures in place to keep them and your customers safe. So one other thing that the HSE have said, and the government, is that where you have created this risk assessment, devising a plan with the measures that you're proposing to put in place, that should be shared on your website if there are 50 or more employees. So again, that's just something I wanted to highlight, and the HSE guidance on that is quite useful in terms of what you should and shouldn't be doing with risk assessments. But it's quite clear you should be consulting with staff on them, and you should be sharing them, and in particular putting them on your website, as I say. Just a couple of other points I mentioned in my in the start what I'm going to cover, and one of this is whistleblowing. You know, it doesn't come up for many businesses very often, but certainly if you have employees on the ground raising health and safety concerns with their managers, and those concerns aren't being taken seriously, you could end up in a situation where you know you're potentially facing employees blowing the whistle. So I think it's just important to make sure staff and employees on the ground, or anyone with, you know, health and safety type responsibility, are fully aware that we need to take concerns seriously. If staff are suggesting things we should be putting in place, or concerned that we're not putting particular things in place to keep them safe, then we address that, we investigate it, and we look into it, and we try to come up with a solution that means that the problem is resolved. So just wanted to highlight that in relation to whistleblowing, and not really going to go into much more detail than that. Another point that I wanted to raise is that, you know, most businesses now are familiar with the fact that, you know, to claim unfair dismissal, employees need to have 2 years continuous service. And therefore, those without 2 years, you know, it's pretty easy to bring their employment to an end. I just wanted to highlight that one of the exceptions to that rule, in addition to discriminatory dismissals, is where an individual has raised a health and safety concern, a genuine one, and on the back of that, they've been dismissed for raising those concerns. So if that is the case, that individual does not need 2 years service to pursue that unfair dismissal claim. So again, it's just something I wanted to highlight, and the importance really of listening to any concerns that are raised from a health and safety perspective. And when I talk about health and safety, I do mean specifically related to COVID-19 and the measures that you're putting in place, social distancing type issues. If employees are refusing to return to work because they feel that it's not safe, you know, you might ultimately need to put them on unpaid leave because they're not back at work. If the furlough scheme's still in existence, you might decide to continue to furlough them employees if that's possible. But yeah, you know, if not, it may be that they are required to go on unpaid leave. But where staff do feel that and have this reasonable sort of belief that there is a serious and imminent danger that could be facing them in terms of a risk, then, you know, that they are able to wear that and to potentially not attend the workplace. So I think for me, a lot of these issues are about sitting down with your staff and consulting with them and speaking to them about these issues that they might have and coming up with a solution that will hopefully work and address the concerns and anxiety that they might have. It's important to note, and all of the guidance is quite clear on this, you know, from Public Health England, from HSE and from the government, that anybody that is shielding, and I'll come on to what that is in a moment, should be the last to be returning to work. These individuals who are shielding have had an official letter from the NHS that's confirming that, I think the initial period is 12 weeks, but you know, we could see that extended. They are not to leave their home. And the government have set an expectation that they consider that businesses should be supporting employees in this situation. Obviously, they can remain on furlough leave, or if they are able to work from home, there's nothing to stop individuals that are shielding, you know, continuing to do that work from home. But yeah, I think it's just important when we're looking at specific needs of employees, those that are pregnant and those that are shielding are of a specific sort of risk, higher risk than the rest of the workforce. Just to finish on that sort of employer duty section, do keep up to date with the government and Public Health England's advice and that of the Health and Safety Executive. They have got their own COVID-19 link. I'll just share my screen so that you can see that one from the Health and Safety Executive. One moment. It's this one. So working safely during the coronavirus outbreak, managing risk, and this also talks about risk assessments and directs you to the government's guidance for the specific industry related information. So I now want to look at, as I said, some specific policies and procedures that I think are impacted by the coronavirus. The first of which is disciplinary and grievances. I've been asked by many clients throughout this sort of lockdown period since March, you know, what happens with disciplinaries or investigations or grievances? How do I deal with that in light of the pandemic? You know, the social distancing measures, the fact we're on lockdown, and what if employees are furloughed? Is that regarded as work? You know, how do I do it? And should they proceed or should we put them off? And the answer is it's going to depend in every situation whether they go ahead. ACAS have produced guidance on this, and they are quite clear that there is nothing to stop you proceeding with this. However, it should be the case that you follow social distancing and all the other public health guidelines if it proceeds, and you consider how you're going to do that if people are working from home or, you know, have you got that ability to do this remotely? Can you, if it's an investigation, speak to all of the relevant parties or not? So, you know, the bottom line is with disciplinary and grievances, you're going to have to look at each one. It will be okay to proceed with them if you opt to do that, as long as these measures are in place and social distancing is considered. But equally, there may be occasions where it's not appropriate to proceed. And one thing that's quite clear from government's guidance is that, you know, individuals who are at home, you know, may have mental health issues surrounding lockdown, and therefore consideration should be given to that, and there should be an element of discussion with those involved in these processes as to whether the parties feel that they should proceed or not. Again, I'm just going to share the ACAS guidance on this. So disciplinary and grievance procedures during the coronavirus pandemic. And it talks about those that are furloughed. So for those that are furloughed, it's not regarded as work. You know, they are able to participate in these processes if, and then it outlines the conditions. So if they're involved directly by way of, you know, it's them that are under investigation, or it's them that have actually raised the grievance to start with, they're chairing it, they're taking notes or being a companion or a witness, then they, it doesn't matter that they're furloughed, they can still participate. But the guidance goes on to say that they should do that out of their own choice, and in line with Public Health England's guidance. It is just guidance that from ACAS, you know, this point about voluntarily, I think will come down to each and every case and deciding, you know, what needs to happen, because clearly in a disciplinary scenario, I suspect the employee is going to be saying that they don't volunteer to attend any investigation or disciplinary meetings. But so, yeah, there's a little bit of guidance there about whether you should be proceeding or not. In terms of the next policy I want to look at is home working, and I know that many businesses already have home working policies in place, but as I've been reviewing these for clients over the last weeks and months, it's very clear that your existing home working policy, if you have one, is not necessarily going to fit the current situation, given, you know, and particularly now the government have come out to say those that can work from home should continue to do so for the foreseeable future. So those that have got policies in place, I think they need to be reviewed. And those that haven't got home working policies in place, you know, my view is that this is really needed at this point in time, so that you can be clear of what the expectations are. You can address this issue of those employees that might be homeschooling, and, you know, what, how you envisage they are going to be able to look after their child and yet work, and if that's going to be okay from your perspective, etc. Or if it's better to furlough the worker. So I do think that having a home working policy, particularly at this point, that's relevant to COVID-19 is essential. So it can pick up on, you know, confidentiality, data protection, practical issues in terms of the equipment that they're using, you know, whether their mortgage and insurance terms allow them to work from home, etc. So that's something that I think businesses should be to be turning in and looking at. Briefly, I wanted to just raise equality and diversity. Now, just because we've got a pandemic on our hands doesn't mean that we should now start to think about equality and diversity. Obviously, it's just something that's always there within business and should always be part of everything that we do to ensure that there is no discrimination. But I just thought it was worth highlighting this, because I know businesses are in really difficult positions at the moment and are making really quick and difficult decisions, you know, such as changing hours of work and, you know, who should be coming back from furlough and who might be selected for redundancy, etc. And so I just wanted to, you know, highlight the importance of ensuring that those are business decisions and, you know, do not relate to any protected characteristics. We've seen the Equality and Human Rights Commission have provided guidance on this in light of COVID-19. And again, you know, it's something that you might want to have a look at. But it does outline some specific type of examples. So if you have an employee that is, you know, shielding or has a disability, ensuring that you are not taking decisions, for example, to make them redundant because, you know, you don't want to make them reasonable adjustments and because of their disability and that sort of thing. And again, with this equality point, I just wanted to raise that if you have employees that are disabled within the workforce, there's always this duty upon businesses to make reasonable adjustments. And that's present, you know, all of the time. But there may be specific aspects of COVID-19 that are disadvantaging particular disabled employees, and therefore you should be having those discussions with staff, looking at any adjustments that you could put in place, and ensuring that you've covered all bases for staff and are not facing a claim for having failed to make any reasonable adjustments down the line. So just in terms of making all of those decisions on, you know, who's working from home, who's coming back from furlough, redundancy decisions, that they are based on business requirements and there's no connection to anyone's protected characteristic, whether that's their age, their disability, their religious belief, you know, their sex or pregnancy, for example. So they were just the three types of policies and procedures I wanted to pull out as having some relevant issues really surrounding the coronavirus. So next, I want to talk about the kind of staffing issues that you might have when people are beginning to return from furlough, if you have furloughed staff. And I think, you know, you've potentially got people being unable to return to work due to childcare issues. We've seen from the government that schools are going to be staged in a return commencing on the 1st of June. But again, it's not set in stone. It's subject to change based on the 5 tests. So there may be individuals that are now having to return to work at this point in time, and both parents are having to do that. There's, you know, potentially grandparents aren't going to be able to assist now because of the need for self-isolation and staying at home, and how you're going to address that, those types of issues, those, as I've talked about before, that are refusing to return to work because they're shielding or have health concerns, or more to the point, I think we'll see a lot of that family members are shielding and how we address that. And then finally, looking at holidays. So when we are looking at these issues surrounding employees returning to work, I think we also need to just factor in the public transport and the fact that some individuals will rely on public transport to get into work, and the government are suggesting that people should avoid it where possible. So I think they are discussions that, again, you'll need to have individually with staff who are in that situation. So I think step one is you sitting back and considering how you're going to approach your staff returning to work, who's going to come back from the furlough scheme first, and ensuring that you make, as I said earlier, decisions based on business reasons, and there is some kind of, you know, real reason as to why people are coming back in the order that they are. As I've already touched on and alluded to earlier, anybody that is shielding should be the last group of individuals that return to work on site. They can continue to work from home, as I've said, but in terms of coming back to work, they should be the last, and they should not be returning to the work until the period of shielding has ended, as per the correspondence that they've had from the NHS. You know, the government has been quite clear that they expect businesses to be supporting shielded employees in that way. Those that are reluctant to return to work but are not officially within that category of shielding, so it's either that, you know, they may have a low level asthma condition, or they may be living with someone who's shielding, or even just be really anxious about the current position. I think there's going to be lots of this happening, and each individual situation is going to have to be considered on a case by case basis. The government advises that these individuals are able to return to work as long as we are putting the measures in place from a safety perspective. So for me, it's about having discussions with these employees, trying to be open and honest with them in conversations, and encourage them by reassuring them with the measures that you're going to be putting in place and how they can return. But if they are still not buying into that process as you're having that consultation with them, then I think, you know, it's important that you are listening to their concerns and looking at other viable options to get them into work. So it could be that they remain furloughed for as long as possible, and that works, and you don't need them back in the business. Or it could be that you move them away from any high contact duties, so they're not, you know, public facing, or they're away doing a project that doesn't involve them being near a significant number of individuals. But any measures that you can put in place to sort of reassure them and get them back to work, I think that's something we should be doing. I have been asked, you know, whether it would be feasible potentially to start to discipline individuals who are not returning to work. And, you know, it's going to be important to look at each individual circumstance and the reason why people are not returning, if it's a health and safety concern and they're genuinely anxious, they genuinely feel that there is a serious risk for them in doing so, to a serious and imminent risk of danger is what the legislation talks about, then it's going to be, you know, you're not going to be on the securest of land in terms of going ahead and disciplining them and taking steps in that way, unless you've gone through every possible channel to come up with solutions and you're still not being able to get these employees to come back to work. And I think in those situations, you know, you are going to need to take advice. The next thing that I want you to deal with is annual leave, and this has been coming up quite a lot in terms of the clients that I'm advising at the moment. We've had some clarity on this, I think, to start with, and it wasn't very clear at all. And just to keep me on my toes, there was some further guidance announced on this yesterday, quite late on. But effectively, what we've got now is a position where we are clear that employees will continue to accrue holiday whilst they're furloughed. That furlough position does not change their accrual of holidays. And it's also clear that they can take holidays whilst furloughed without that furlough period coming to an end or being interrupted in any way. Any employees that are taking holiday during furlough period must be topped up by their employer to 100% of their normal pay and not the furlough rate. But, you know, businesses have always been able to give notice to employees if they require them to take annual leave. And this is something I'm seeing businesses doing more and more at the moment. And it absolutely makes sense. You know, you're going to have a large number of employees potentially that have been furloughed from, you know, March to October, accruing a significant proportion of their holiday for the year. And then just as you're trying to get business back on, you know, on track, and then wanting to take significant number of holidays, what you can actually do is serve notice on employees now whilst they're furloughed, to require them to take some annual leave while they're furloughed. There is commentary that should be proportionate, and therefore a lot of the businesses I've been assisting have been looking at you know, the amount of holiday they've accrued in this period being taken by employees, or, you know, employees taking a week or so during this furlough period. But it absolutely makes sense from an employer's perspective, because it reduces the amount of holiday employees are going to, you know, be required to take when things become a bit more normal down the line, and lockdown is we're out of lockdown. But it also means that the government are covering 80% of that holiday pay and you're just topping up the additional 20%. So, as I said, that's something that businesses can be doing and they are doing. And you may have seen our update, I think it's still on the website at the moment, that talks about how the government have extended the leave year so that employees who've been unable to take leave because of COVID-19 are able to take it in the following two leave years. And this guidance that we saw yesterday, and I'll just share it briefly, talks about holidays. Is it this one? Oh, I think I've lost my link to the holiday point. Sorry about that. We will share it in the comments section so that you've got it. But that talks a little bit more about where it has been not reasonably practicable for individuals to take this holiday leave, and therefore if it's not been reasonably practicable, the employer can insist that they take it in the following 2 years. And it gives some quite useful guidance of examples of where it's not, you know, it would be considered to be not reasonably practicable for a worker to have taken that leave. The next point that I want to come on to is changes to terms and conditions of employment. I think in many cases that's going to involve where businesses are wanting to reduce hours and reduce pay. And again, I've been talking to businesses this week and last week about the need for that. I think the extension of the furlough scheme is going to assist. I think where businesses were having to look now at you know, how they were going to do that at the end of the furlough scheme, we've now got a much longer period of time to allow workers to be receiving their pay under the furlough scheme. And as I said, by the end of May, we'll see how the transition goes from July to October in terms of the part-time shift and businesses being able to bring people back and share the salary costs with employers, with the government under the scheme. But in any event, I think there will still be situations where businesses are needing to make changes to terms and conditions. So again, this is the type of area that you know, I'd always advise you to be taking specific advice on, but I just wanted to talk you through the loose process of how you would go about that. So in some instances, the contract itself allows you to make changes to the contractual terms. So for example, if you are changing hours, you may have a flexible hours clause that is quite clear that employees will work at any set hours, and therefore the changes that you are making are sort of already agreed by the contract. But in the vast majority of cases, you're not going to have a contractual right to implement these changes, such as, you know, if you're going to a 4-day week, for example. So how do you go about making those changes to an employee's contract? Well, the first and easiest way of going about this is to seek your employee's agreement. And I certainly can say from having spoken to businesses and been advising them on these types of issues that, you know, many employees are understanding that businesses are in an unprecedented time and are having to make these changes to avoid making people redundant. So hopefully, you know, in that process of seeking agreement, you could be consulting with employees to outline why these changes are needed, how long they're likely to be needed, or whether it's a permanent change, and trying to seek their agreement. Now, if employees agree to changes, that's absolutely the easiest and best way to go about it. And you would just simply record that change to their terms and conditions by way of a letter or an updated contract. And again, where that agreement is not possible, there are two other ways that you can go about this. The first is that you just actually implement this change to their terms and conditions. And if the employee continues to attend work over a period of time, they're deemed to have impliedly accepted that change by their conduct of coming to work. Obviously, there's a risk associated with that method, because employees could resign and seek to claim constructive dismissal, saying that these changes are a fundamental change in their contract and therefore they're, you know, they're not able to continue to work for the business anymore. We're in difficult times, and I hope that, you know, employees will be able to see these changes as necessary and why they're needed, because if they do resign, you know, there may not be significant work out for them to uptake. So I don't know how that would go in terms of unilaterally imposing it, but it would depend on the type of change you're introducing. But that's one option. And then the other option, the final option, is that you terminate the employee's existing terms and conditions of employment and offer them re-engagement, re-employment immediately on new terms and conditions of employment. But it's important to note that where you are, you know, if we're having to go through that stage of terminating employment, if there is a proposal to dismiss 20 or more employees by this means, and that's within a minimum of 90 days or less, sorry, a period of 90 days or less, then you are obliged to collectively consult with your employees. And that's something that, again, I'd be asking, recommending that you take legal advice on. Because if you fall foul of that, the compliance, that the failure to comply can be significant. You could be ordered to pay a protective award of up to 90 days pay for each employee for failing to collectively consult. And the failure to notify the Secretary of State, which is something that you're also required to do under this collective consultation, could lead to a fine for the business. So if you are proposing to make 20 or more redundant or terminate their employment on this basis, then collective consultation will be required. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on to look at redundancies. So if you as a business have looked at all other options available to you as a means to avoid redundancies within the workplace. But there are no other ways that you can do, you know, continue to put those measures in place. You know, you may be left with a situation that you're having to make redundancies. The furlough scheme is complicating that a little bit, because I think where furlough is available, there may be an expectation that you keep employees on the furlough scheme. How that will change in that July to October period, we'll have to see when the flesh is on the bone later this month. But I think, you know, the first steps that businesses need to be looking at are things like asking for volunteers for redundancy, and most certainly looking at those employees with less than 2 years service, because as we touched on earlier, they do not have the right to pursue an unfair dismissal claim if they are dismissed by reason of redundancy. And they're also not entitled to a statutory redundancy payment. So they are the least risky category of individuals to look at to make redundant. And strictly speaking, you won't need to follow any real detailed process, although many businesses often do from a good practice perspective. So if you are then in a situation where you're having to conduct a redundancy consultation exercise with staff, the first stage really of a redundancy process is identifying if you meet the definition of redundancy. And I don't want to go into that into too much detail, but effectively there are three ways to achieve that. One is a business closure, one is a workplace closure, and one, which is likely to be the most relevant, is where there is a reduced requirement for employees to carry out work of a particular kind. So you have to be satisfied that you meet that definition of redundancy. And then once you do, there is a process that I'm sure you'll all be familiar with that needs to be followed. Again, just picking up on the collective consultation point I raised in terms of terms and conditions, if you are proposing to make 20 or more employees redundant at one establishment over a period of 90 days or less, then you must collectively consult with staff. And that involves consulting with employee representatives that might need to be elected if they're not in place already. And that collective consultation period for redundancies of less than 100 is for 30 days. And whether there are 100 or more redundancies that are proposed, it's for 45 days. So I'm mentioning this because what is quite clear is that businesses can start consulting with staff during the furlough period and even serving notice on employees so that the furlough period is effectively covering salary for the consultation process that, you know, collective consultation is relevant, maybe 30 or 45 days. With collective consultation, in addition to informing and consulting employees, employee reps, as I've said, there is also a need to serve a HR1 form on the Secretary of State. So just a little bit of a whistle-stop tour of redundancy and the process that you would need to follow. You effectively need to decide which aspects of the business are going to involve redundancy, and within those, channeling down as to what are the pools for redundancy selection. And what I mean by that is, you know, you may have 5 customer service assistants, let's say, and you need to lose 2 of them. The selection pool may be those 5 customer service assistants who all do the same job, who are all working at the same workplace, and they, you know, create this selection pool. And from that, you then need to be consulting with the pool and looking at means to avoid their redundancy via that, you know, genuine and meaningful consultation process that you engage with. There will be a selection criteria for which these individuals will be scored. And you may use criteria such as, you know, attendance, disciplinary record, their skill set, their length of service, for example, score each individual, and those that come up with the least number of points are those that are ultimately selected for redundancy. And also, as part of a fair redundancy process, you need to consider suitable alternative employment and effectively looking if there are any other roles within the business that you could place the you know, the employee in as a means to avoiding their redundancy. Of course, anyone with over 2 years service will be entitled to a statutory redundancy payment. That can be calculated. There's a government website. There's a calculator on that. It easily produces the figures for individuals. And of course, you will have notice and holiday pay. If you are serving notice during the furlough period, it's argued that you should be paying their notice pay at their full normal rate of pay, not the furlough rate. And likewise for holiday pay. But as I said, I would always be saying take legal advice on any redundancy process, just due to the sort of complexities involved and the potential consequences for getting them wrong in terms of claims. So I am looking to just have a look at what questions are in the comments box now. And I will look to answer some of those if there are any. Let me just have a quick. So just the one question. Is there a COVID specific risk assessment template? I don't have a specific risk assessment template, but the HSE website does talk in a lot of detail about risk assessments. And what they need to include. And as I mentioned before, I would absolutely be working through the measures that I've talked about in this session, but are also I highlighted in those government guidance notes. And particularly useful are the industry or sector related guidance notes, because they talk you through the measures that you could and should be putting in place. So that's what I would be suggesting, you know, formulates that risk assessment. But no, I don't have a specific template for risk assessments, because it sort of falls within health and safety, really. So I think that's all on the questions front. If there are any other questions that people have, feel free to add them on the comments box or follow up with an email and we'll pick those up. If we have a lot of questions, maybe that we do sort of recorded question and answer session, but it will depend how many questions we get for that. I really do hope that you know, this whistle stop tour has been helpful, that you've taken some valuable points from it. You know, I do want to highlight that this session does not supersede the need to take specific advice, particularly on the changes to terms and conditions and the redundancy process, and of course any health and safety related matters from any specific health and safety specialists. We will send a follow-up email from today's session, firstly asking for some feedback. You know, we really do take on board your feedback. We really listen to anything that you've got to say as means to, you know, what you'd like to see going forward, how you found the sessions and if they're helpful. We'll also include a link for you to sign up to our e-alerts and bulletins, and that's not just for employment. You have the option to be able to to tick other types of bulletins that the firm might be sending out in terms of different departments. So you have the option on that. But obviously, if you do have any specific questions or want to get in touch about any of the issues from today's session, let us know. But we will attach the checklist that I talked about that you can use towards your risk assessment, going back to that question we've had, and all of the links of the guidance notes that I've referred to. We'll send out on the email as well. But thank you very much for attending. I'm really grateful for that. And as I said, I hope it's been useful.